Now we begin. Tonight's session, on the eve of Purim, is not necessarily chronological with the Jewish life cycle, because in our last session we analyzed the ksuba, which is at the wedding. There's got to be something between the wedding and get, and surely there is. But which we will have to come back to evaluate. But the reason that I jump is not that I want to push life so fast, but the kesuba and the get are intrinsically bound. You cannot talk about one without the other. Okay. As a matter of fact, in the order in Talmud, the volume, the masechta called Gittin, which deals with get, comes before the volume called Kiddushin, which is marriage. And there is good reason for it. Because you see a book, what would you think of a book that didn't have a front cover operating in consonance with and complementing the rear, the back cover? It is two sides of one process. And that's the way it has to be viewed. Whatever is done with the kesuba, as we mentioned in the past and analyzed in the past with all the commitments, must be undone by the get. There's no way out of that. That's the whole secret of get. Probably, I can be finished in a few moments, and pitifully few moments, in telling you what I want to tell you, and then I would appreciate hearing from you and ask the rabbi style, so that this session may be a little atypical. Let's hear what you have to say, and I will try to answer. And it is such a terribly complicated situation, without any doubt. Let me begin, therefore, in the three pages that I have given you, with my preliminary information questionnaire relating to a get. I want to bring you into the world of the rabbi who is involved, even preliminarily, in trying to get a get. This isn't just an ordinary form with which one plays to be able to establish some kind of a relationship or formality. There are some important things over here which will become evident to you once we see the get. Names and addresses and home phone numbers and business phones and business addresses, that's nonsense. But once you get down to number 7, your Hebrew name given at birth is one of the stickiest things that we have. Here are some of the sticky problems. A, people don't know the name that they were given at birth, because in past generations, it may be a bubby or a great uncle who only retained the tradition of knowing the Hebrew name after whom you are being named. And the bubby and the uncle are now long gone, and you've never used your Hebrew name. And you have no certification. You have nothing with things written on it, except for a ksuba. But do you know how many ksubas were inoperative that I have in a file? Because even the best of rabbis could not establish and ascertain what the true name was, and then with subsequent investigation, what was on the kesuba was not the true name. What do you do?
Use the same name on the get?
Well, I'm leaving it as a question. Okay? There was one last mishmash of a member of this community whose chuppah and ksuba was executed by a very well-learned and experienced rav in the community. And years went by and the get was needed, and they subsequently turned to me. And the only way that we were able to get out of it was to completely ignore all the evidence and use her English name, which is so atypical, because that was the only thing that we were sure of. I know she had a social security card. Her name was there. I know she has a driver's license. Her name and picture were there. I know her signature because it's on her checking account, and we compared it. That's the way she signs her name, and the bank recognizes it. I have nothing else legally that sticks. Absolutely nothing. It's one of the big problems. Then, in certain families, we have the problem with the father's Hebrew as well. There we run into some other problems. Let's, in your case, let's say, you when with Ephron's name, I kept on saying Ephraim. And you were telling me Ephraim.
No,
Ephraim. Ephraim. You were insistent. Now, I'm not saying it any differently than you, except for one thing. Your mode of speech and my dialect were two different dialects. Your mode of speech and dialect were more Yiddishized than the actual name itself. In Ephron's situation, we knew exactly how to identify the name. But what do we do if a person, for instance, is called Malka? Even though I'm dealing with the father's name, but Malka is a woman's name. And all of a sudden, a name turns up with Malya. Instead of a K as the third letter, the third consonant, it's a Y. Could we say that this was a mispronunciation of the name? Could we say that it is a nickname? Or could we say that it's an entirely different name? I have no less than 10 major encyclopedic volumes just recording tens and untold tens of thousands of names to be able to establish what it's all about. It becomes even compounded further. When you say to me Ephraim, or Ephraim, whichever way you want it, I know it's in the Chumash. I open up any Chumash in this universe, even on Mars if there is a Chumash, I know exactly what the story is. But what do I do with Yenta and Weindel? These are not Hebrew names. And what, not only Yiddish names, what do I do with Polish names and Ukrainian names and Russian names and Sephardic names? And now we have America. This is, and in 200 years from now, if there will be no American Jewish community and the base of Jewish operation will be elsewhere, it's going to be unbelievable. Priscilla, Percival, and Quincy, and God knows what. I don't say this mockingly, but understand the process. I need the full name. You know what one of the biggest crises was in the last 85 years, let's say from the beginning of the 1900s, when the influx came from Russia in the beginning in the 1880s. It's now 100 years since the Russian and Polish immigration. So we started naming people John or Jack. Yaakov became Jack from Jacob. How do you write Jack? What is the Hebrew letter for J? Any idea? J. You want to put a Yud in? Yak? Yaka? There is no technical, now watch carefully, there is no technical letter by us Ashkenazim. There is a technical letter, you know where? By the Sfardim. Because there is a J in Arabic. It is a gimel
with a
stroke, as is indicated, and the G sound, the hard G in Arabic, at the beginning of a word or a syllable is pronounced not G, but J. But excuse me, you a Sfardi? You have any Sephardi blood in you? You an Arab? No. You know how we maintain such strict, loyalty to our ways. If God forbid you'll change a chant from a Russian way to a Polish way or a German way to a Hungarian way, there can be national crises, let alone the legal spelling of these names. There's incredible, incredible difficulty. And several spellings arose. Well, I cannot spell it your way because Sfardim do that. Ashkenazim would put a gimel with a stroke, it's still a G. So, let's analyze it. So it's Dalet Zion, but the Zion's got to be if you're a Litvak. What if you're not a Litvak? Alright, so it's John. All this exists in the literature, so it's Dalet Tes Shin. It bores you, right? We go crazy over it. I tell my constant sorrow that I've told 100 times. The first get that came to my attention in this city was going on 17 years ago. Man was a Polish fellow, came from Poland. No problem, we had the Kasuba. Just didn't go. And I took him in to New York and arranged the get. He speaks Yiddish, that's his mother tongue, so I have nothing to worry about. And the three Rabbonim are sitting there and they only speak Yiddish, so there's no language barrier. And the Av Beis Din, the head of the court, asks him the first thing. Viazei Hestia, what's your name? So he says, Chai. Vi ruft menach. How do they call you? He says to him, Henry.
Henry.
He says, Nochamol, again. He says, Henry. 2-3 times, Henry. He says, Vi leit min sois. How do you spell it? So he says to him, H, E, N, A, Y. How do you say it? Henry. He says, listen to what you said. Start again, spelling. How do you say, how do you pronounce it? He says, huh, yeah, good. Now, spell your name again. H-E-N-R-Y. How do you say it? Henry. This is, without exaggeration, 25 minutes. This is a legality. This is an incredible legality. Goes back to the same thing as Malka and Malia. What do I call her? Do I call her Malka or do I call her Malia? Or are you mispronouncing the K and making it a Y for some strange reason? Whether your grandmother or your grandfather had a speech impediment, or it was a diminutive, is like John, Johnny, or something like that. Avram becomes Bumi.
Is that weird?
Yeah, Bumi is Avram. Sure, no. Any Bumi Schwartz is Avram Schwartz. That's it. That's it. Bumi Wallfish is an Avram Wallfish. That's it. And that's now, is that the case, or does this man truly have a name called Henry? These legalities and get are essential to us. No less essential than it is for your Social Security, where you have constant reminder, make sure that your employer goes ahead and copies your name and your number correctly, because it means, that's all, I can't say it any better. It has legal status, the way you spell your name. This is some of the fun. Nope, when you get down to number 9, are you a Kohen or a Levi or Yisrael? So you can already imagine in certain families where we don't begin to know what's going on. Number 10, the question that I put in here surely was inspired by this Henry situation. Are you known by any other names by family, friends, or business associates? Because if you deal in legalities, you know the Rosh Tevis, you know the abbreviation AKK, also known as. Then you put the whole list of aliases. John, also known as Johnny, also known as Sonny, also known as you. Okay? And there you go. And the same thing with the father in 12. And in 13, do we have Hebrew names? Do we have Yiddish names? Do people know him by any other names? It's only a matter of identification. And number 14, as a result of the difficulties, number 14 was again inspired by experience. Do you know after whom you were named in Hebrew? Because if you were named after a grandmother and her name was Esther Malka and you don't know, and you can tell me that you were named after your grandmother, and I'll ask you, is your grandmother alive? And you say, no. I say, where is she buried? And she's buried in Menorah Cemetery. Menorah Cemetery is right around the corner. You know where it is? Yeah. Come, let's see. Maybe 15 years ago, I'll have a clue. And I come to the gravesite, and I see it's not Esther Malka. It has absolutely no relationship to do with Esther Malka. It's a different name altogether. Have you ever changed your name? No. Did anyone change it for you? No. Where did you get Esther Malka? Well, I went to Talmud Torah, and in religious school in the first grade, they had to give me a name. And they asked me what my name is, and I said it was Ellen. And what's your middle name? And my middle name is Marsha. So Ellen Marsha is Esther Malka. That's it. And finished. There you go. I, your Bobby, is Shangle. has absolutely nothing to do with Esther Malka. Only experience. These are the stories that go on, and there's probably no way out of it. And number 15 is the same thing. You see, what is the source of your information that you gave in the last question? How do you know that you were named after someone? That's where we come to this certification, where Baruch Hashem now, if we have intelligent individuals giving out naming certificates or a bris certificate, that it makes life a little easier. And number 27 shouldn't surprise you at all. A person comes to me and says, I want a divorce. I have a right to say to him or to her, prove to me that you are you. There's only question, no question about it. I'll be happy to, to assist you. But if I don't know you or didn't know you in the past, I need identification. That's number one. The fun of having to institute a get is sometimes no fun, just from these stupid little technicalities that in my tender years I have already experienced. So you can well imagine what Shuli, your mother, goes through. Unfortunately, she is the one. We should have suspended. We should have suspended today's session because of the absence of Shuli's mother.
What does mother do? I mean,
she is.
She works for the vets of the Rabbinical Council of America. She is their secretary.
Oh, so she's involved.
She sits at the crossroads of all the action.
She fills this out over the phone. So this is high. I want to get. This is what she fills.
I know.
Oh, that's a preliminary. Is that
yeah, that and she gets everything together.
Oh, yeah.
Just loved.
That's a nice.
Oh, that's a Freudian slip.
For the record, this form.
Yes, ma'am. That has pouch.
What number?
This marriage dissolved. It has half was this marriage is loved.
Yeah.
That's cute.
This love, right?
Shouldn't it be half and half?
Yeah.
Yeah. This love. That's cute.
Yeah, but I have since corrected it. Well, let's go on. That brings us to the second document. Let me just show you what a get is. And then the rest of the time, ask me questions. You have two sheets in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
Before we get to the get itself, take a look at the description of what actually goes on. The get is a handwritten, unattached piece of paper, meaning that it must be able to be delivered. Cannot write it on wallpaper. Okay, it must be in your possession if you are the recipient of the get. It must be in your possession if you are the originator, the husband, originator of the get. And it's written by a sofer, just the way a Sefer Torah is written, in script, with the same restrictions and requirements that you have in writing the Sefer Torah. I'll give you a simple situation. One of the myriad of requirements in the Sefer Torah is that every letter has got to have its own space, its own territory. Now, you know the letter Lamed has a long giraffe-like neck that sticks up. And if the letter Lamed sticks up into the space, the territorial area of another letter, it could change the form of the letter, which renders the get null and void, just like tefillin and mezuzah and sefer Torah. These are legal requirements. Don't get too scared with these legalities, because you want to know something? If the wedding invitation that you will yet have for your children will have one letter sticking up into the line above that you are paying $475 for per hundred, you will send the whole batch back. And you won't ask any questions, and they won't ask any questions. You're entitled to a new batch. So why not here? Same thing. The composition of the get is very simple. It contains five things. Number one is a simple statement that the husband divorces the wife. You know why? And this is the critical part. Who signed his name, so to speak, to the dotted line of commitment in the kesubah? The husband. You remember the kesubah? Even the shirt off of my back, I, the husband, give to you. If that's the case, the one who gives has got to cut off, or so to speak, stop the time clock from running. And that is the essence of Kesubah. It has, no, needless to say, it has a difficult aspect with the recalcitrant husband, the husband who does not want to give a get. But it's a simple technicality. If I am committing myself, I have got to go ahead and stop that commitment. If I have written a check, and the check is lost, and I don't want it cashed, I am the one who will have to go to the bank, and I will be empowered to stop payment on that check. Simple as that. The second statement is the statement that once the get is granted, there is absolutely no further relationship between the husband and the wife. For if there is, you know, let's be friends kind of a thing, then it invalidates the get. If, however, it's a let's be friends and we'll be married again, that is a mitzvah. Simple as that. Number three, the time and the place of the writing of the get. Since this is a very important thing, you will soon see that we make a whole to-do about various places where the get is issued. Number four, the get must be written for the wife specifically, and must specify all the names by which she is known in Hebrew and in English, and I say Yiddish also, her Jewish name also, her father's Hebrew name and English name, and any designation as a Kohen or a Levi, and by extension it has to be the husband also, simply for the purposes of identification. As we spoke when we did the Ksuba in the Lubavitch community, do you know how many Menachem Mendels there are named after the Lubavitch Rebbe? So I need a Menachem Mendel who sits in this city, who is also called by the following seven names, and then his mother calls him an eighth name, only for the sake of identification. And number five, as we said before, the get must be written on a separate piece of paper so that when it is completed, it is a self-contained document that can be presented to the wife, and she takes possession of it so that the minute she takes possession of it, the clock stops, and that's it. Let's take a look at the get itself. The last two short lines are the signatures of the witnesses. The first witness is Chaim Mordechai ben David Svi HaKohen. The last word is aid, which means witness. And the second one is Aaron Zev ben Aryeh aid, witness. You see that there is a substantive difference in the style of writing between those two short lines and the lines above. Well, obviously, because the witnesses are amateurs, so to speak. They do not have to be sofrim, they don't have to be scribes, but they must know at least how to fundamentally shape the letters. For if we were to require that every witness know exactly how to write as a sofer, then we would be in big trouble. But, on the other hand, I'm not going to allow him to sign his John Hancock in English. So it is somewhat of a concession, a conceptual concession.
Why wouldn't you allow him to sign in English?
Because this is a legal document that has certain legal restrictions. The same way I wouldn't allow it to be written in French. It isn't even in Hebrew, this document. The legal language is the language of the Talmud, the same thing as the Ksuba. All right, so the question arises, what about Hebrew script, which is taught all over? And there are cases, there are precedents, where there is no one else around that probably, de facto, what we say, b'di'evet, under duress, we will go ahead and take it. Better would be if a person who knows how to write in Hebrew could be taught by the sofer and practice how to do the letters. Now, this I've seen myself, where at the RCA we had to sit and worry about certain individuals and make sure they knew how to form the letters. But it is a rare thing, you know why? Because wherever a get is granted, you surely have at least six people who are readily knowledgeable in everything that has to do with the get. So eliminate those. The Adim in this situation will always be men. Okay? That has nothing to do with womanhood, by the way. David HaMelech could not be an aid either. Moshe Rabbeinu could not be an aid either. You see. And they were very much men. you see, the problem that we have here is the sensitivity that we don't have as legal minds to what constitutes legal testimony. Law has all kinds of technicalities. And this is one of the technicalities. I can give you some romantic reasoning behind it, but you can shoot it to pieces. All right? I'll give it to you anyway. You didn't ask for it, but I'll give it to you anyway. The Torah forbids a woman to testify in any kind of a situation where there could be physical retribution. We never wanted to put a woman on the line. The Torah allows a woman to testify whether a whole factory of meat is kosher or a $5 million a year business goes out of existence. But I will never allow her to get involved in anything where there could be the McKillicuddies and the McNiffs shooting at one another. That's why she does not testify at a murder trial. That's why she does not testify at any kind of business dealings where between two partners or the defendant and the plaintiff you can have all kinds of bows and arrows and knives. Why? We don't want retribution. We don't want to allow her to be compromised in this manner. It's a good reason. It can be shot to pieces, however. But if Moshe Rabbeinu couldn't testify, then I think you ought to be satisfied. Simple as that. David HaMelech was not allowed to testify or be a witness. So leave the two witnesses alone for a minute, and then please count the rest of the lines.
Why would they not
do it? Oh, the reasons of technicalities that don't allow us to get fair, even, balanced, and uniform testimony. A simple example. David HaMelech says that she committed adultery. Okay? Which means that there are grounds for immediate divorce and certain settlement matters are erased as a result of it. And there are two witnesses who say David HaMelech has cataracts. He never saw her. And if he did see her, it was only his distorted vision of her. Can you tell me who's going to stand up against David HaMelech and say you're as blind as a bat? Okay? Not fair. Because when a witness goes ahead and testifies to something, he must be able to put his neck on the chopping block so that two other witnesses or 20 other witnesses come and say, you're a liar. I'm a liar? Let's prove it. Let's see what your evidence is and let's see what my evidence is. If I'm a liar, you will negate my testimony and the consequences thereof. And if you're a liar, we'll negate your testimony and the consequences thereof. Can you, do you think anyone would stand up against a king, the David HaMelech, a Moshe Rabbeinu who had the status of a king? And ipso facto, sorry, you are no longer a valid witness. I got a better one. Do you think in general, in principle, that I would know how to sign my name to such a document? I think it would be safe to say that I know how to sign my name. Okay? My cousin, or my uncle, or my son is involved in a get, or for that matter, a tshuva. I am invalid as a witness.
You would be partial.
I'm invalid. Simple. No more and no less invalid than a woman would be to sign this. But once again, in ritual matters, the testimony of a woman, one woman can outweigh sometimes the testimony of 20 men. Simple. A mashgiach who has to give testimony doesn't know his hands from his feet as to what is a kosher chicken or what is not a kosher chicken. I don't care how long his beard, one little 13-year-old girl who knows exactly what to look for outweighs his entire credibility. Simple. How many lines did you count?
12.
Every get is written in 12 lines. There's no such thing as a get in more lines.
Is this why this is stretched out?
Yep. And that's why you understand.
12 is the number.
12. Why 12?
Well,
it's an ancient minhag. No two ways about it. But the word get has two letters to it. The gimel, which you know, transfers into numerals is a 3, like an aleph is 1. The bezes. So gimel is 3 and a tes is 9. 3 and 9 are a grand total of 12. That's the way it's occurred. Now, if the word for get was different, maybe yes, maybe no, we would have different numbers of lines. But this is only a mnemonic device, a memory device, to be able to understand what's going on here. Let's see what happens. You want to follow along in English? You have the text of the get on the other page that I gave you. But more than anything else, I want to show you the problems of this person. I am clear that there isn't a single person who would be able to identify this get. It was a get that I was involved in. Sorrowfully, this gentleman had to go through it twice for very interesting reasons. Be'echod b'Shabbos, on the first day of the week, Shabbos. So that's Sunday. B'shisha osar yom, on the 16th day, li'yerach Iyar, in the month of Iyar, which was right after Pesach, Shnas 5742, the year 5742, Libriyasa Olam, from creation of the world, Leminyan, as is counted, She'onu Monim Kan bin New York. New York, right? Everyone knows where New York is, but that's not good enough. The last two words of the second line, Musa, it's a city, the Yasva that is situated, the third line, Al Kifyama, on the banks of an ocean. The Al Nahar Hudson. And not only on the Atlantic Ocean, but also it is on the other end, we have the Hudson River. That's a matter of identification. What are you doing to say it? Okay? Now you see a very interesting thing. We have problems with certain cities that don't have bodies of water. Passaic, from time immemorial, has been a get city. Patterson has been a get city because we have waterways over there as a matter of identification. Muncie. The waterways over there. It was a major faith crisis that Rav Moshe Feinstein had to settle. I mean, now that Muncie has what? 200,000 Jews? 250,000 Jews? I don't know what the count is. But there is no waterway there. It does not have this golden stream of nourishment and purity like we have running down Route 21, the Passaic River. What do you do? And we had to devise a very interesting kind of a formula to be able to indicate that Muncie is Muncie. But it says something else. It has absolutely nothing to do with get. And I want you to listen to this carefully. In the 1600s, when the Jews first landed, the first 23 Jews landed in the New World, you know, on this part of the New World. Where did they disembark? Have any idea? Well, that's 1880.
On the Mayflower.
Plymouth Rock. They came in by how? By boat. They came in by boat. And they disembarked. Where did they set up their settlement?
Massachusetts.
On the banks of a river or an ocean. That's where civilization was. Now go up and down all the rivers in the United States of America. Those are the cities where Jews settled first. They didn't settle in Montana because there are no rivers in Montana. They did settle in New Orleans. You know why? Because it's right at the mouth of the Mississippi, right? Am I right? Mississippi, that's what it is. They did settle along the Atlantic Ocean, and when they came to New York, to New Amsterdam, do you know where the first Jewish settlement was? Battery Park, the tip of Manhattan, where the water is, where you swing around from the west side to the east side. That was the first Jewish community.
You sure it wasn't because of the trade routes?
Well, what else? It's the same thing. It's identical. It's identically the same thing. You came here because you wanted to trade. You needed a living. What better people was suited for export and import, or what you call the trade routes, than the Jews, who had connections all over? And it does not change. Spain and Portugal are on water. England and France are on water. Germany, Frankfurt am Main, on the Main River, or Frankfurt am Oder, on the Oder River. And the large Jewish communities, Odessa in Russia, is on the Black Sea. Now, we have seas, we have waterways to identify. Passaic and Patterson have waterways with which to identify them.
If
I don't have Muncie.
Why can't we use other than waterways of Muncie to, you know, land
well,
railroads?
You see...
No, you know, Tunnel Dunfermline...
There's only one problem. You see, there's only one problem. If they asked you the question of Muncie first, so you would have written the decision before of Moshe Feinstein, and you know what, you would have been already. You would have been up there. This is basically how we have to go ahead and so to speak, skin the problem. But it's revolutionary. Because now the patterns of colonization is not by water. Patterns of colonization are elsewhere. Okay? Take all of your first, your colonial towns. Newport, Rhode Island, it's right on the sea. Virginia, Norfolk, old Jewish community. South Carolina, same thing with Charleston. It wasn't too far off. Savannah. These are all coastal towns. Let's go further. We're on the third line, the 2, 4, 6, 7, 6th word. Hudson. You see the Nahar Hudson, the Hudson River. Anna, I, Avram Yaakov. That's a nice Jewish name. The Miskerei. Who is called Avraham, v'hamechuna Beri. Mechuna means I am given a name and known as Beri. It's not a Jewish name, so therefore you don't call me that name, even though people know me as such. Beri. Ben Pinchas, the next line, ha-mechuna, who is known as Philip. Ha'omeid ayom b'New York. I'm standing right here in New York. And then the rest of the text is just simple. Absolutely simple. You see it in English. No more complications whatsoever. If you go back to the English one, it's about the fifth line in English. My own free will without being compelled to do so. We'll have some talk about that later. Declare my intention to divorce and free you, my wife, the name. You have been my wife from before. I free and release you so that you can marry anyone you wish and no one can prohibit you from doing this. Today and forever you are free to marry any man. This will be in your hands a book of divorce, a legal document of divorce, and a document of freedom according to the laws of Moses and in Israel. And that's all the get says. There isn't one dollars worth of financial settlement in the get. Simple as that. These are all matters that are discussed and settled and finished. The only thing is, I married you, I bound you, I divorce you. Sounds kind of difficult, but I beg you to understand what the issue is here, and that's the issue of technicalities. And I gave you this technicality situation. If the husband is signing a kesuba, it is the husband that has to cancel the kesuba. You sign the kesuba, you write a get. That's it. Thank God that rabbinic law in the ideal state is a little more civilized than other laws. And it went ahead and moved on one of the two biggest fallacies. If I have to divorce my wife of my own free will and consent, the Talmud in the times of Hillel and Shammai discuss what if you take and you salt my food excessively, and as a result, I get sick. I have a right to divorce you. That's theoretical. You honestly think that the Talmud is going to let man get away with that? In a fit of anger or insanity, just go ahead and say, that's it? No way. Now you go back to the kesuba. Now you understand why the kesuba was an entirely financial